Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. As people look to see if there'll be a truce between the Palestinians in Gaza and the Israelis, we have a conversation with Rami Khoury. Rami Khoury has been covering the Middle East for the last 40 years. He's Palestinian. He's one of the Middle East's leading journalists. Rami Khoury is director of the Issam Ferris Institute of Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's also a syndicated columnist for the Beirut-based newspaper, The Daily Star, where he was once executive editor. And he joins us from his home in Beirut. So, Rami Khoury, there are all kinds of indications that a ceasefire will be made and that President Morsi of Egypt is working on it. We see Secretary of State Clinton is heading to Cairo, to Jerusalem and Ramallah. If a truce comes, let's say, today or tomorrow, what will that really mean?
If a truce comes, it means a truce will come, but it doesn't mean anything else in terms of resolving the underlying issues that cause this conflict to keep erupting every few years into an increasingly savage and brutal war. The irony of Clinton going to Cairo, Ramallah, and Tel Aviv is that she's not going to Gaza, and that's where the main issue is, and the fact that she's not going to Gaza is symptomatic of how the Americans are essentially on the sidelines now. They're still involved, obviously, because the Israelis won't do anything without the Americans backing them up. But the Americans are no longer leading the mediation. They've shuffled themselves out of this game because of their utter failure over 20 years of mediation, basically because they weren't even-handed. They were essentially coming down on the Israeli side every time. Mm-hmm. And one of the great developments now is that the Turks, the Qataris, and the Egyptians are taking the lead on the mediation. The Americans and the Europeans and others are playing a role, but it's not the leading role anymore. So if you get a ceasefire, they'll stop shooting at each other for a while, and then something else will happen months or a year down the road, and they'll have another war. This has been the pattern for the last about 20 years or so, ever since Hamas became a serious resistance movement, mainly based in Gaza. The issue is not to have a ceasefire. The issue is to remove the underlying causes of the conflict. And the underlying causes of the conflict are not only the Israelis getting out of the land they occupied in 1967, it's the Israelis removing the siege of Gaza that they have and not attacking and assassinating people. And it's addressing the underlying deeper causes for both sides, which are for the Palestinians to end their refugeehood and statelessness, and for the Israelis to be accepted fully as a sovereign state in the Middle East and to have normal relations, peaceful relations with the Arab countries. Those are the tougher long-term issues. But the immediate short-term issue for the ceasefire is to stop the fighting on both sides, the attacks on each other, and to remove the siege that the Israelis have put on Gaza. That's the reason why you have these resistance groups emerging out of Gaza with increasing determination and technical proficiency every few years. They're now firing rockets north of Tel Aviv, which they weren't doing a few years ago. Really, the ceasefire shouldn't be exaggerated. It's good to have a ceasefire. It's better for people not to kill each other than to kill each other. But if they have a ceasefire and they haven't resolved the underlying causes, they'll just go back to killing each other. So we need more enlightened political leadership, I think, to really deal with this issue fully.
Well, if what you say, if your analysis is correct, and it sounds very correct in many ways, and the United States is losing power, influence to broker any deals, what does that say, A, for the future of what you described, and B, in terms of the power of President Morsi and the new Egypt and of Turkey, and how you see that playing out?
Well, this is a really significant new thing that's happening, or one of the significant new things that's happening. Regional players, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Egypt primarily are emerging as much more important diplomatic players in the region. And this is the first instance now this Gaza crisis, where you have coming together the role of these regional or some of these regional actors with the impact of the last 2 years of Arab revolutions and uprisings and the beginning of the development of democratic and legitimate Arab governments. So you have somebody like President Morsi in Egypt who is legitimate, is elected, is democratic, and he really reflects the sentiments of his people. And that's why after the fighting started, he immediately sent his prime minister to go to Gaza, and the Tunisian sent their foreign minister to go to Gaza. It's a symbolic move, but it's a much more substantive move than anything Hosni Mubarak ever did for the people in Gaza. So these new players are playing a different role, which is not just that they're more effective mediators, because they actually pay attention to the legitimate rights of both parties, and not like the Americans did, to mainly focus on Israeli rights and making Palestinian rights secondary. These guys are looking at Israel's legitimate rights to live in peace and security, and the Palestinians having the same rights simultaneously. Not one day in the future, maybe we'll see what happens, which was the Dennis Ross and Clinton and Bush and Obama approach, which has failed miserably. And the second part of the emergence of these powers is that, you know, Turkey, it's no accident that Turkey is one of these new players, because they also have a democratically elected legitimate government, which also comes out of an Islamist tradition, though it's mild Islamism compared to the Muslim Brothers and others in the Arab countries. But these leaders really reflect the sentiments of their people, and therefore they will play a more decisive role that is going to have more integrity in trying to bring about a real lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians, if they can get to that point. They're not doing that right now. They're just looking at a ceasefire. But it's possible that they might shift into a higher gear and say, well, let's see if we can forge a negotiation where the Arabs and the Israelis actually negotiate a permanent peace, because that would have to bring in the Lebanese and the Syrians as well.
And so I'm curious, again, you know, you are an observer and analyze this for many, many years. And you're sitting in a country now, you know, where you're on the border of Syria, where the conflict is intensifying. Nobody's really sure how that's going to play out, but Turkey's involved there, and so is Iran on some levels as well. And you've got these two new power bases you talked about of Turkey and Egypt, and I wonder if you kind of think about what that might mean in terms of Israel. I could see Israel becoming even more recalcitrant in the face of its only ally being the United States of America, and being more resistant to any kind of change. I mean, that could be a scenario that would play out.
That Israel would be more isolated?
Yep.
Yes, Israel has become much more isolated. I mean, Israel and Turkey used to be very close friends. Israel and Iran, 35 years ago, were very close friends and exchanged their security cooperation and oil and other things. And Israel has essentially lost all of its friends in the region. The two countries that it has peace agreements with, Jordan and Egypt, have very, very frosty people-to-people relations, a very cold peace. And the Israelis are extremely isolated. And they're acting in a very foolish way by essentially repeating the mistakes of the past, which is to engage the Palestinians almost purely on the basis of massive military onslaughts, which is what they're doing again. And they used to think that, well, the Arabs only understand violence, and you've got to beat them up and shatter them and teach them a lesson, and then they'll be acquiescent and they'll behave. And exactly the opposite is happening. Every generation of Palestinians is more determined to fight for its rights and is technically more proficient. So, you know, what the Palestinians were doing 40 years ago is some guy would sneak across the border with a rifle and shoot an Israeli. Now they're firing sophisticated missiles north of Tel Aviv. And everything the Israelis have done has failed. They've put up fences. They put up walls. They've had free fire zones. They occupied. They annexed. They colonized. They put thousands of people in jail. They laid siege to Gaza. Every single thing they've tried to do has backfired. And the determination of the people in Gaza and their technical proficiency have both continued to increase over time. to the point where the Israelis are being forced to ask for a ceasefire, and I'm prepared to bet a double cheeseburger with hot sauce, or a double falafel with hot sauce, whatever you prefer, that the ceasefire call, that the ceasefire agreement that happens, is going to include a second stage where the Israelis have to lift the embargo, lift the siege off Gaza, or significantly reduce it, or open up the Rafah crossing of Egypt, so that the people of Gaza can live in a normal way, which would be a gain for the resistance. The Palestinians would say, well, we forced the Israelis to do this. So the Israelis really have a lot of thinking to do, because they remain very powerful, but their power is increasingly ineffective when it is only used at the level of the military onslaughts, which is the case now. It's like the Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan. They can bring in all kinds of amazing weapons and blow people to smithereens. But then they do that for 5, 6, 7 years, and they realize that they're getting nowhere, and they leave, which is exactly what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Soviets learned the same thing in Afghanistan. The Americans learned it in Vietnam. The French learned it in Algeria. Colonial powers learn these lessons over and over. They're a little bit stupid. They don't sort of digest the lessons of other colonial powers, but they make the same mistakes. And the Israelis are making the exact same mistakes at their level of regional colonialism.
So, Rami, I wonder, as a man who knows the United States of America, who knows his baseball, shall I say, I'm curious what you think would change America. What would move America to be willing to talk to the Palestinian leadership and Hamas, would be willing to kind of be more of an even broker, if that's even a possibility. I mean, you grew up here, you know this place. I mean, you know all those worlds. What do you think the dynamic might be that would change things in America?
Well, it's peculiar to see the American government so structurally pro-Israeli, where the American people, we know from polling evidence over and over, are much more fair. The American people tend to say they want both the Israelis and the Palestinians to both enjoy security and statehood and a normal, peaceful life. Whereas the American government in its policies leans much more towards the Israeli side. The only explanation, I think, is that the political class in America sees it in its own self-interest to adopt a pro-Israeli position. I can't think of any other possible explanation, because America's strategic interests in the Middle East are being increasingly hurt and whittled down by this very strong pro-Israeli position. Hamas has never threatened the United States. It's never really killed Americans. Has never gone after Americans or threatened them. Hamas has no problem with America. So why does the U.S. refuse to speak to a democratically elected Hamas when the U.S. is prepared to sit and negotiate with the Taliban? The Taliban are killing Americans. So there's a very bizarre reason why the U.S. takes this anti-Hamas, pro-Israel policy. And I think it's much more related to the contorted, distorted, bizarre world of American domestic politics, where American politicians tend to be frightened to take a view of Israel that's very critical. And we've seen this happen in the past with Chuck Percy and Paul Finley and others who've taken positions that are critical of Israel, and it was the last position they took because they didn't get reelected. So that's, to me, the most logical explanation. I can't think of any other one. The cause of justice and peace and freedom and democracy that the U.S. says that it preaches all over the world is best served by being an even-handed mediator, as it was so in Northern Ireland, and achieving a peace between Palestinians and Israelis that is fair to both sides. Obama tried a little bit in recent years to push him out of the Israeli peace process, and he failed utterly. He got pushback from the Israelis. He didn't get much cooperation from the Arabs, and he didn't take it very far. He had other things on his mind, presumably economic problems and Afghanistan and other things, so he dropped it, and it's unlikely that we're going to see the United States try again to push for a negotiated Arab-Israeli peace. If they are going to try again, they should be a little bit more sophisticated, more steady on the course, to stick with it, but most importantly, to be more even-handed. They've got to be seen as even-handed mediators. And that's the American way. It's surprising that the United States acts very American in most things and acts like the former Soviet Union when it comes to Arab-Israeli issues, very one-sided and distorted and et cetera. So, you know, it doesn't act like the great purveyor of democracy and freedom and inequality that says it is. So it's one of these unfortunate developments of modern history that we just have to live with. The only thing that will make the United States change, I think, is if the United States actually starts suffering from as a cause of this policy. If something were to happen that would directly hurt Americans or American interests, and the United States people realize that this is because they're not even-handed, because they're one-sided, it's possible then that the United States could say, well, look, we have to change our policy and really push for a resolution of this conflict that gives the Palestinians and the Israelis both a normal, peaceful, secure life. There's no sign of that happening. And the American reaction to this latest Gaza fighting is symptomatic of that, where Barack Obama, who's an extremely sophisticated, intelligent, and decent man, who I have huge respect for, acted like an infantile imbecile when he came out and just said, repeated almost verbatim, the pro-Israeli talking points that, well, every country has a right to defend itself and nobody would live like the Israelis live with rockets firing at them from Gaza. And this is just right out of Netanyahu and Mark Rogers' talking points and AIPAC's talking points. And it's really beneath the dignity and probably the moral commitment that the American president made when he swore on the Constitution to take a position like that. It's really sad to see a fine man like Barack Obama take this position. But this is what American politicians do. We're not surprised. It's happened many times, and it happened again a few days ago. And this is something Americans have to deal with in their own world of political morality.
And so, and finally, Rami, I'm curious, I mean, about what you think about the Palestinian end of this in terms of you've been to Gaza. You've obviously been all over the Middle East. Your family, you are Palestinian. I'm curious what you think the future is in terms of what will be acceptable to the Palestinian people and what you think that future is. I harken back to the election where Hamas won, and then nobody would recognize Hamas as a legitimate leader of the Palestinian Authority. If they had, we might be in a different place today. But I wonder what you think the pulse of the Palestinian people are in terms of what they're willing to accept and what that future will bring. Because you hear people all the time saying, this can't stop until Palestinians stop firing rockets, stop throwing rocks, whatever that happens to be. So I'm curious what you think of your sense of that is.
Well, the Palestinian people have made it very clear, the people as a whole and the leadership, over and over again, including Hamas, by the way, they've made it very clear that they're prepared to live in a situation in which Israel exists as it is now, as a Jewish majority state, about 80% Jewish. And the Arabs are prepared to live with it and recognize it and have normal relations with it if it leaves the occupied territories of 67 and resolves the refugee issue of the Palestinians in a way that's negotiated and accepted by the Israelis and the Palestinians. Nothing will be imposed on either side, but negotiated according to UN resolutions of international law. So, Hamas has said if the Palestinians in a referendum accept any kind of peace agreement in a majority referendum, that Hamas will abide by it. In other words, Hamas is not imposing its own position on the rest of the Palestinians. Hamas does not acknowledge the legitimacy of the state of Israel. Just as many Americans for years did not recognize the legitimacy of the Cuban government or the what they used to call Red China, People's Republic of China. And Hamas says, we don't recognize the legitimacy of Israel. But Hamas has made deals with the Israelis, ceasefires, prisoner exchanges, border agreements, all kinds of things. So Hamas doesn't recognize the legitimacy of Israel, but recognizes the reality of Israel. And it is, they're a very sensible group of people who are also focused on resistance to the kind of occupation, criminal dehumanization that has been the Israeli policy towards them, and they will resist it. The name Hamas means Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya. It's an acronym in Arabic for Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement. Resistance is the operative word in their name. It's what they do. They're a resistance group, and they resist in many different ways, including militarily. And they have forced the Israelis to get out of Gaza to begin with, but then the Israelis pulled out and laid siege to the place and reached the point where Palestinian children now, according to UN statistics, are stunted and malnourished. And the Hamas won't put up with this. The previous Palestinian governments would just complain to the UN and do nothing about it. These guys are different. This is a different breed of leaders. And they will fight back. They won't put up with this kind of nonsense of being mistreated in a racist, colonial way. And they'll fight back in different ways. One of them is with military causing pain to the Israelis. And the Israelis felt real pain this year. When those sirens went off in Tel Aviv, and the Israelis were scurrying around, running into bomb shelters, they were very uncomfortable. And that's the whole point of firing rockets at them, to make them feel the same pain that the Palestinians feel year after year after year when the Israelis attack them and bomb them and assassinate them and put them in jail and thousands at a time and cut off the drinking water and cut off electricity and cut off their fuel and starve them and do all the terrible things that the Israelis have done. And Hamas has succeeded where nobody else has, to force the Israelis to get out of the territories. And now, for the second time, they're going to force the Israelis to have a ceasefire in the war that the Israelis essentially started. So this is a whole new breed of this is a new mindset among Palestinians. Not all Palestinians support Hamas. Probably 30% or so support it.
How much? What percent did you say?
Probably 30%. 20 to 30% is the natural sort of support base for Hamas. It goes up and down. So the majority of Palestinians didn't vote for Hamas when they had the election victory back in 2006, I think it was. Hamas won around 35% of the vote, but the other people split the vote, and they had the plurality. Therefore, they had the prime minister's position. But the majority of Palestinians don't support Hamas, but they certainly will support it now in a war condition. And when they see that Hamas's policy possibly may be effective in forcing the Israelis to pull the siege, pull back the siege that they've laid on Gaza, they'll probably generate more support, and people will say, well, if this is the only way to live like normal human beings, we'll do it. But in the long run, people are not looking for an Islamic state or a religious state or anything like that. They just want to end the occupations that they've been suffering under Israeli hands and colonization, and to end their refugeehood. And all Palestinians basically agree on the outlines of a peace agreement with Israel, which is incorporated into the Arab Peace Plan of 2002 that all the Arab countries signed, which is still on the table. And the Israelis and Americans have refused to deal with it, have rejected it completely. So the problems in Israel and the United States, the problem is not in Palestine. Palestinians have given every concession that has been asked of them to recognize Israel, to recognize its right to exist, to sign peace treaties with it, to agree on a permanent peace, to have normal relations, open trade relations. They've done absolutely everything that has been asked for them, and they've got virtually nothing in return. The Israelis will give cosmetic concessions here and there on withdrawing from some of the occupied lands and things like that, but they have never yet seriously addressed the core issue for the Palestinians, which is refugeehood and exile and statelessness. And if the Israelis are not going to do that, there will never be a peace. This conflict will go on for years. And the Israelis need to understand that the Palestinians in 1947, 48, when the Palestinian problem started, there were 750,000 Palestinian refugees. There's now 4.5 million of those refugees outside Palestine. And they're getting more and more proficient and more politically organized. So time is not on Israel's side. It can have, bunker buster bombs. It can have all kinds of sophisticated drones. It can have whatever it wants. But it can never defeat the will of people to live in a free and normal society. And that's what the Palestinians represent now.
Rami Khoury, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us. Thank you for all the time you've given our listeners today.
Okay, it's my pleasure, and I hope the Orioles do better next year.
Thank you, Rami. So do we.